Continuing with Norm Broughton on 7 August 78.
These systems are form the basis of smart arrays, you know, which are used in radar.
In what sense now?
Smart arrays in radar are ones in which the antennas are scanned or formed, made to follow something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the compound system is part of the system, and by changing the phase between different antennas, you can now make them scan.
I see.
And they sort of servo to follow on targets. And
did you know about this sort of, and was this sort of thing going on in the military at that time?
No, I think this came after.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is it.
Let me just ask this as an aside, while it occurs to me. I don't think, is it not true that Canadian radio astronomy has never been funded by the military?
That is correct.
In the same, U.S.
Never,
radio astronomy has had so much input at that time anyway.
Never been any military funding in astronomy.
It's all been through the National Research Council.
Yes. Almost all. There's been a little bit of work done at a place called the Defense Research Board by a fellow by the name of Ted Hartz.
Hartz?
Hartz, yes. H-A-R-T-Z. Who was funded by the Defense Research Board, which was effectively a military establishment. Yeah.
But that was a very minor.
That was very small amount, yeah.
All right. Now, is there any other solar work that you were involved with that we should cover? I don't see anything else here in the abstracts.
Oh, some solar eclipses.
Oh, yes, that's right. In June 54, there was one here mentioned.
Right.
Were there some others that... Were there any expeditions you went on, or were they just the ones that happened to come over?
No, I didn't go on any expeditions. Although Mr. Covington took his equipment off on a solar eclipse expedition in Quebec. But we, after the Algonquin Radio Observatory was established, we had there operating a 10-meter antenna, which Dr. Higgs and I fitted out for a 6-centimeter operation, 5-centimeter operation as was, and with a scanning beam in which we scanned around, continuously around the limb of the sun and watched the moon bite into it.
I see. What size antenna was this?
It was 10 meters.
Mm-hmm. And this would, what year was this?
This was 1953, I think it was.
But I thought you said you took it to Algonquin.
That was at Algonquin. 1963.
Oh, 63, yeah.
I'm more than 10 years out, yeah.
Okay, well, speaking of Algonquin, here you have a paper with Pattinson and Aitken in 58, in which you are doing a site survey for the Canadian National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Could you tell me how this concept came up and then how that developed, the concept for a national observatory?
Yes, well, the concept of a national facility had been growing for some time. Prior to this time, the need for a national facility was evident. And coupled with that was the fact that our solar observing site near Ottawa was being swamped more and more with both military and airport radars.
Mm-hmm.
So it was evident we were going to have to change sites for the solar work as well. So two concepts kind of coupled together. With the permission of the National Research Council, we set out to establish a site for a national facility.
Was there any push to get into non-solar work also?
Yes, the push was there for some years. The funds wasn't.
Who were the people that were interested in it?
Well, myself chiefly, and to a certain extent, Mr. Mayed.
And another question is, do the optical astronomers have any role in this? Were you pretty well distinct from them?
At this time, we were distinct because at that time, government astronomy in Canada was operated under two branches. One was the National Research Council, which all the solar radio work was done on. And about 1960-61, also with the establishment of the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory at Penticton under Mines and Technical Surveys or something like that. The government astronomy as a whole had been done under a department similar in name to the Mines and Technical Surveys because of the support which the survey people gave to Canada as a whole, and the Dominion Observatory was formed and formed part of that. And then later
in
on...
In Victoria? Or do you mean...
At Ottawa.
The Dominion Observatory in Ottawa.
Okay. Yes. And then later on, the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria was formed and operated by the same department. In 1970, I believe, the government transferred the responsibility of all astronomy to the National Research Council.
No, but these, Dominion Observatory and DAO had been around for a long time.
Yes.
Had they not? Yeah.
Yes.
But you were not in particular contact with this idea
in
for...
In contact, but not...
Well, not any close cooperation
right,
or of any
right.
kind.
Yeah.
Not even with the solar optical astronomers?
To a certain extent, it was somewhat limited because the... By this time, the site at Ottawa, the Dominion Observatory, more or less ceased to function as an operating observatory, except for the PSAT-T tubes and the transmit. Mm-hmm.
For reasons of interference also, I suppose.
For reasons of interference, light interference.
Right. In fact, if I remember correctly from Covington's papers primarily, I think you may have had good connections with University of Michigan.
Yes.
Optical.
Helen Dodson
right.
and the people down there, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
In general, let me ask, when you talked about solar work in the radio, were you talking with the solar optical astronomers, or was it pretty much talking to other radio astronomers? Which did you feel more a part of the community?
Well, pre-1960,
yes.
I think radio astronomy as a whole was isolated from the optical. And in fact, IRSI used to be the only place in which radio astronomy papers were given. They were not accepted at the American Astronomical Society. So, I think that it really wasn't until more galactic work was done that radio astronomy became accepted as a branch of astronomy. It was really considered as an option.
Right.
Reber couldn't get his stuff published really through the...
Well, let's be fair now, he did get it published in APJ, even in the early 1940s.
That's right, but he didn't really get much attention from the optical people.
No. But now, do you have some... You say you couldn't give a paper at a AAAS meeting. Do you have some personal experience in that, or are you just saying that no one bothered to...
No one bothered
to go to these
because
meetings.
There weren't any radio astronomers going to them.
Yeah.
So there wasn't any point in giving a paper there.
One exception I do know about, though, is the hydrogen work done at Harvard. Bopp, of course, being official. So
yes.
They did give papers.
Yes.
But I think otherwise, the statement is quite correct. Okay,
and
well...
they gave more papers at IRSI.
Yeah.
Than they did
at
the AAAS.
Well, going back to the site survey for the Canadian NRAO, can you tell me what your requirements were and where this led you in terms of the site?
Oh, the same thing as the requirements for any radio astronomy observatory. Isolation from interference.
But was it important that it be in Eastern Canada, for instance?
Not essential that it be in Eastern Canada, but Western Canada was being served by the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory, in effect. And therefore, it was more logical to try and establish one in Eastern Canada, mm-hmm. near the large universities of Toronto and Queens.
Yeah, and especially since you've got quite a bit of wilderness area in Eastern Canada.
Yes.
But I'm still a little bit confused. Why not just put this thing at Penticton? Unless it's a matter of convenience. You're establishing an observatory there about the same time.
Well, I think that's partly political in that, Canada is a pretty big country, and to try and travel back and forth. Travel was even more difficult in those days. And the politics of it was such that it was probably easier to get money to establish something which would be of service and of usefulness to the Eastern universities, which are large, rather than this put it in the West again. So there was one in the West which was established the year before the Algonquin. At least the site survey was approved the year before. And so really probably more of a matter of politics to establish one in the East.
So
just as you have a fairly large observatory at Caltech and you have one at NRA in Quebec, so, in the States.
But what's different, though, is that both of these in the Canada are national in some sense. At least one's called Dominion and the other's called National.
No, the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory is not.
Oh, I see. Maybe that's my misunderstanding.
A national facility.
Despite this name, which would tend to make it look like it's for the entire Dominion, is it really more like the Naval Research Lab in terms of it's a government-funded thing? And outsiders don't really have access to it unless they know the people.
Outsiders do have access to it, but it's by nature, the type of instrumentation is more a long-term program type of thing than it is a short-term program.
Visitor-oriented.
So visitor-oriented ones come to the Algonquin.
And was this the concept right from the very beginning?
This was the concept from the beginning. Yeah.
And this is also about the same time that NRAO was beginning to get going in the late 50s. Were there any contacts there to try to learn from each other and how to do this? Although, of course, neither of you had a model, a previously existing national observatory. This was rather different from the British and Australian style. Well, another question that pops to mind is that in the U.S., as you're probably aware, there was some opposition from the universities to an NRAO because they felt it would be taking funds away, essentially, and they were rather dubious about the value, but it seems like from what you said that it wasn't that way in Canada.
No,
the universities wanted to.
I think they wanted it rather than because funds for continuing programs, funds for developing major instrumentation is much more difficult to get in Canada for universities than it is for, say, a government agency.
I see.
If you get you can get a development grant to build something, the funds for continuing the operation of it, or something which aren't covered under that development grant.
Right. Once you get your foot in the door.
That's right. The university then has to see where to get the funds from this. Mm. And to apply year by year for operating funds for something is not very good.
Yeah.
So I think that they were happy and pleased in that sense that the National Research Council could provide this, and the University of Toronto always had a very firm interest in the Algonquin Radio Observatory right from the very commencement on.
Mm-hmm. Was that the primary university that
was
pushing for it? What were the others?
Queen's University was also pushing for it at Kingston, but to a lesser extent at that time than right now, although they turned out to be a major user of it too.
Okay, well, having located the Algonquin site, you just mentioned before that you moved up some solar equipment to use it right away. Do I have that right? And that was in what year?
1960. It started January 1960.
And then what was the plan at that stage for the big dish? What were your goals to have?
Well, our goals were for a dish off the order of 150 feet in diameter. That being sort of a diameter we thought that we could get funds for. Although we were somewhat concerned because of the problems that they had with the 140-foot beam bank.
We're having
at that time. We were encouraged by the very great success, which was evident at the CSIRO at Parkes, antenna. And so we, in fact, opted for going back to the same designers.
Freeman Fox.
Since they had achieved something at Parkes, which was quite successful. And we went back to them and asked them to design us a radio telescope.
And in what respects does the 150-foot differ from the Park's fish, or is it quite similar?
Well, it's similar in many ways, but it differs from any other radio telescope in that the surface, which is quarter-inch plate, over 36 meters of it, interacts with the ribs and forms part of the deflecting structure, the support structure.
I see.
So that is, it is different in that fashion. It is different in as much as we had specified that our droppage 10 centimeters over 150 feet, 3 centimeters over 120, whereas the Park zone was specified for 21 centimeters over there, 210 feet. In fact, we use the whole 150 feet in 3 centimeters, and the inner portion down as far as one centimeter.
You have in recent years.
Yes. Right.
So was this the first time that a dish had been sort of designed for an intersection to have somewhat higher accuracy? Or are you just saying that because you had a somewhat smaller dish, you could push it up to a shorter wavelengths?
I think that would be a fair statement to say that. And yet it may not be, because Parks had in mind using the inner 17 meters of their dish at a higher frequency.
Which, of course, they are still working on.
Which they are working on and have achieved excellent success. Yeah. But Parks and our dish certainly would be the first ones in which they had a concept of better resolution. Although everyone recognizes that the gravitational distortion is worse towards the edge of the dish than it is in the second one.
Sure. Well, the dish you said got on the air in 1966 or so.
Yes.
There was a period of 6 years in there. Did everything go relatively smoothly, or what were the troubles or highlights during that period of building this facility?
There were essentially no problems in building the telescope, We had operating at the site a 10-meter telescope, in which some work was done. And after the original specifications, the initial design of the 150-foot and 46-meter were complete, I spent 2 years in Australia doing some research and came back about the time the dish was ready for some of its commissioning tests.
Yeah. Which 2 years were those?
63 to 65.
So you were working with the new Parks dish, I suppose,
yes,
primarily.
That's right.
What kind of work?
What kind of work? Well, Magellanic clouds, polarization of the galaxy at 600 megahertz, some 30 megahertz operation, and 5 centimeter observation of the galactic center.
30 megahertz?
Yes.
Using what for antenna?
The Park station.
The Park station?
Yes.
Good Lord.
On that, so then I did the 30 megahertz. The major work there, which I did, was probably the Magellanic Cloud, 10 centimeter survey of the Magellanic Cloud.
But this was more or less getting geared up and waiting for the Algonquin dish to get ready, I guess.
In essence, yes. I felt that I would like to do some research at Parks and at the same time perhaps become familiar with the problems they might have in that telescope.
With a large antenna, yes.
And therefore get some knowledge of the problems we might have of our own.
And once the antenna was turned over, more or less, to the radio astronomers, did it operate quite well? Were there any particular problems? Or was it?
No, there were no.
Met the specs pretty well?
Yeah, met the specs.
Just like the Park station, in other words,
yeah.
The Freeman Fox delivered.
There was no problems.
Delivered
at all.
Again. Now, there is one other topic which we should talk about, and this occurred to me, and that is you were involved, were you not, in the first successful VLBI in
yes.
Canada? And so I would like to hear in the closing about that effort. How did this idea come about, and could you just tell me the story?
The idea had a germ back in 1961, I guess it was, at the opening of the Penticton dish. And at the same time, Canada had a radar station operating at Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, about 1,000 kilometers away from Penticton. And at the opening of this Penticton dish, there was a suggestion that the Penticton dish and the Catawba dish might be used together as an interferometer, although used a very basic suggestion. And concepts had not been worked out, and in fact any thoughts on it were perhaps faulty at that time. And it lay there and dormant for a number of years.
But the idea was that there would be independent recording of the signals and later combination?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. The idea lay dormant then until about 1965, and about the time I returned from Australia. And I'm not too sure who had sort of started again. It was Herb Gush from the University of Toronto, Alan Yen, or Dr. Locke, that I met with Dr. Galt at Penticton on my way back from Australia, and he says, have you heard anything about the idea of doing the long baseline interferometry? And I said, no, I'm just coming back. So he briefed me in it, and then we joined in with the group in October of 65 to supply some funds and knowledge and manpower.
We say we joined in. Who?
The National Research Council.
I see. And yeah. They had not been previously involved in.
Well, they hadn't really been anything concrete done. The first organization meeting was in October 65. Just general discussion between ourselves. Of course, some discussion had gone on before I come back from Australia between, I think, Penticton group and University of Toronto group.
I had talked to John Gold.
It hadn't really gone too far, I don't think, at that stage, and none of the concepts had been worked out or what to do. So, the National Research Council then supplied almost all the money for putting the long baseline interferometer together. A good deal of the manpower in terms of our engineers and our astronomers too. So we had fun 2 or 3 years.
What was the key that made people think about this? Was it all of a sudden the availability of rubidium oscillators? Or?
No. The experiment could have been done 15 years before.
15?
Yes. The key really was the discovery of sources whose amplitude fluctuations were short duration. That is to say, sources varied in the order of a few months, and therefore had to be very small diameter cores.
I see. So you mean in the 50s no one would think that there would be milliarc seconds?
That's right. No one dreamed that there'd be anything in a milliarc second. And the sources of the order of light months, light weeks in diameter or something.
And so these microwave short period variations that were discovered around 65, 66, you're saying, were the...
Were the key part, yes.
But now, fill me in. I didn't realize that technically this could have been done so early.
The tape recorders we used had been used, were discarded traded in CBC video tape recorders from 19, they'd had for 10 or 15 years. The hydrogen masers we used for the last of the line, which Gary and we were experimenting with, and they'd had hydrogen masers going before that. Rubidium clocks had been around for about 15 years. So the whole experiment could have been done before.
Well, I didn't realize that. So it was really mainly the astronomical knowledge that tipped it off rather than the techniques.
Certainly the idea of how to put these techniques together required a bit of work and a bit of thoughts, how to do it. But the need for doing it was not really evident before.
Yeah. Or might one say that one also had to have the experience at, primarily at Jodrell Bank and somewhat in Australia, moving out to longer and longer baselines
and still
getting fringes.
Well, that was Jodrell Bank
that
did that. It wasn't Australia at that time. There's certainly some of that, but of course, I think the clue to anyone thinking in terms of this was the fact that there was sources were varying in the order of weeks and months and intensity, and no way can we do these if they're very large sources.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell me in terms of the actual observing, once you had put together a system, did it pretty much just, the fringes just fall out, or?
Well, we had our problems, like the American group did.
Were you knowledgeable that they were going on?
Oh, yes. Ken Kellerman and I were in weekly contact with each other, finding out what our status was. Very friendly rivalry going on between us.
Right.
And, yes, we had some problems in getting it operating, and we opted to go for the whole distance between Algonquin and Penticton to start with, after having done an experiment on the site between the 10-meter dish and the 46-meter dish, which was just separated by 200 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went out to Penticton and played the tapes back and got nothing. And so we got a little worried about that. So we then pulled our tape recorder and oscillator back to Ottawa, some 186 kilometers, and got all kinds of stuff. And essentially the same sort of thing happened in the United States, where they got fringes to NRL, but they didn't get
from
any fringes.
Green Bank, right.
They didn't get any fringes to Arecibo. Well, we went back to our tapes we had taken and played them, and finally discovered that what we'd had was a very small time jump in the recording, a few microseconds, and so our correlation wasn't at the spot we thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did that, we then found our fringes loud and clear.
I see. So you weren't searching, assuming different clock errors.
Oh yes, you search, but it isn't quite the same, you know.
Yeah. When you really know where you should be looking, you look hard, yeah.
Our techniques were more rudimentary at that time. We didn't do them quite the same we do now.
And I suppose that when you obtained the fringes on the short baselines and not on the very long one, you weren't sure whether you'd resolved the source or something hadn't worked also. So that
that's,
once again,
there's always these possibilities, yes.
Right. Yeah. But was there any attempt then at an intermediate sort of baseline?
No. We continued with... after we had the success, which was announced at a joint U.S.-Canadian IRC in 1967 in Ottawa.
I see. I didn't realize that. How appropriate.
Well, it's even more astonishing than that. Dr. Yen and I had been trying to get this correlation in the tapes at our observatory where we were doing it. And it just finished working about 24 hours when we got the first fringes. On a Saturday, we worked then all day, worked all day Sunday to get these better and defined.
Yeah, right.
Drove down without any sleep to Ottawa. And Monday morning presented them at the conference.
I see. Had you already sent in an abstract about this?
No.
This is an unscheduled paper.
Yeah. Well, we were to speak at the IRCI conference on the technique. And so was the American group under Marshall Cohen, who was also to speak at it.
Right. Okay, well, let me ask you a general question. Someone in the 1950s, the late 50s, said at a cocktail party or something, what do you call yourself, or what do you do? What would have been your answer at that time?
In the late 50s?
Yeah.
I would call myself an astronomer.
An astronomer?
Yes.
You wouldn't even say radio astronomer. I see. So despite the fact that you weren't invited, so to speak, to astronomical meetings, you still felt yourself an astronomer.
Yes, I think that the feeling has always been radio astronomy has been just another phase of astronomy. I don't think the feeling has ever been any different.
Amongst the radio astronomers, I think.
Amongst the radio astronomers. Yeah. The reason why IRCI was used more than the AAS was for two reasons, maybe three reasons. One, that they didn't feel at home giving their papers in the optical sessions, but more that in the early days, a great deal of what you were doing was technical. And all the early radio astronomers were also technical people, did some of their own work.
Right.
Nowadays, people graduate in astronomy and expect the equipment to work and get the results, but that was not the case. We had to build our own equipment, everything. So Hersey was a place where you came and gave your technical results, where you came and presented your astronomical results, and where you met other radio astronomers. In the early 50s, there probably weren't more than about 50 radio astronomers around the whole world,
right.
And you knew them all.
Right, thank you very much.
Okay.
That finishes talking with Norm Broughton.
Can you tell it?
That finishes Norm Broughton on 7 August 1978. This is talking with Frank Drake.